By and large, the news on the viral front is good. So COVID-19 rates nationwide are downtrending, as are hospitalizations and deaths. Of course, we do still see an incredibly high number of deaths nationwide, far higher than we would see in any severe flu season. So it's still a very serious virus that's important to take seriously, but things are moving in a positive direction at the nationwide level and locally as well. In Washington state, case rates are relatively flat, hospitalizations are downtrending, and death rates are relatively flat as well. In Jefferson County, our current case rate, we have 55 cases diagnosed in the last 2 weeks and 158 cases per 100,000 as our case rate, with a case ascertainment rate of 1 in 13 at this point. We have one person currently hospitalized for COVID-19 and no new deaths to report today. So a total of 34 deaths so far in this response, which does remain one of the lowest death rates in the country. Looking at our wastewater surveillance, we've seen a really marked downtrend in COVID-19 viral detection in wastewater, but a small uptick in the last couple of weeks, just by about 10%. I'm super concerned about at this point, but it's just a trend that we are watching. At this point, the dominant variant in our region and in the state as a whole is XBB 1.5, the one that really caused a lot of headache on the East Coast. But we've yet to see a significant spike in severity or frank numbers of infections and hospitalizations in our region or in the state as a whole. And that particularly Jefferson appears to be better protected against that than some of our neighbors. We've not seen the surge of cases here that we've seen in other parts of the state or the country. And we think the biggest driver of that is the percentage of our population who is vaccinated with the bivalent booster. As we've talked about on this program in the past, the bivalent booster covers for BA4 and 5. And BA5 is very, very similar in structure to XBB1, which is the dominant variant circulating now. So it continues to provide very good protection against COVID-19. In fact, in my own household, we recently experienced a pretty significant COVID-19 exposure. We're all bivalent boosted and didn't go on to develop COVID-19. And so we're really hopeful that the bivalent is providing us a high level of protection. On the influenza front, activity is now low. We're seeing less than 1% positivity on samples that are sent, and less than 1% of emergency department visits at this point are for influenza-like illness. RSV continues to downtrend with a percent positivity of 4.2. So all in all, a lot of good news in our region. I'm really hopeful. The most likely outcome is that we have managed to get through without the XBB surge that we saw in the rest of the country because of how well vaccinated we are. Now, it is always possible. There's an outside possibility that a surge is just late in arriving here, and we'll know more probably the next time I talk to you in about 2 weeks. But so far, we just have not seen that surge materialize. And I'm really hopeful that because of how well vaccinated our community is, that we may have really been able to get past that, that challenge that much of the rest of the country face. So I think we are moving into a better phase of the pandemic. We do have a lot more tools at our disposal than we had this time last year. We've got an excellent booster available for anyone over 6 months of age. We have high quality masks that we can use in crowded settings. At this point, we've talked a lot about masking on this program. And the guidance at this point is that we recommend that you wear a high quality mask if you are high risk yourself, or if someone in your household is high risk, or if you're in a crowded setting. So if you think buses, trains, planes, crowded indoor meetings, all of those times are particularly important for wearing a mask. Because we're seeing things move in a much better direction, I think it is reasonable in smaller group gatherings indoors to unmask if everybody is in a safe place. That's an option that I think is reasonable to consider at this point, now that flu and RSV are fading out and that COVID is moving into a better space. But it's always important to look at your own risk and the risk of the people around you, and then look at the risk of the environment that you're in. If it's a really crowded space, lots of people sharing some stagnant airspace, that's a good time to mask up. Or if you're high risk or someone in your household is. And remember, the golden rule we've talked about on this program before. If someone in your sphere is wearing an N95 or a KN95 or higher, they probably would like you to too. And so it's a good time to think about masking to support our neighbors, because we have many people in our community who remain at high risk in spite of this promising direction of our data at this point. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions for Dr. Berry?
I have one. Dr. Berry, the White House announced that they're going to rescind the COVID emergency, I believe, in May. And we are also taking a look at ours currently, which we did keep in place. Do you have an opinion on when would be appropriate to do that?
Great question. I don't have a strong opinion on the Jefferson County emergency order. I think the rescinding of the nationwide order is going to come with some complexity. Particularly, the nationwide order has made it possible to pay for treatments, to have free vaccines, to have free telehealth services, to make sure that the VA people, from veterans in our community, can access telehealth services out here and not have to travel to Seattle. So there's a bunch of good things that came from that declaration of emergency. I don't think that the declaration of emergency needs to be persistent, but I do think we need to come up with policy solutions to make those kind of programs more permanently accessible. There's no reason that I can think of why a veteran should have to travel to Seattle to see their doctor if they don't want to. There are some policy fixes that we, at largely a nationwide level, but sometimes at a more state or local level, we could consider enacting without a state of emergency, so we're prepared for when those states of emergency are lifted.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, that's helpful. Anything, Heidi?
Nope, I think we're good. I checked my flow chart again this morning and answered my question, so.
I share some of the questions with the KPTZ listeners, so I'll defer to them for now.
So the first question was asking about towards the end of the year, we had what looked like a really significant rise in COVID-19 deaths in Clallam County. It was not actually a surge in deaths, but what it was a backlog of deaths that hadn't been reported to our department. There were two primary reasons for that. One of those reasons was that we are very stringent in both of our counties in checking our COVID-19 deaths. You might have heard some of the news reports suggesting that people were being logged as COVID deaths and they didn't even die of COVID. So we've always been incredibly stringent about that. We review every death certificate, every medical record. If there's any possibility that it's not COVID, we make sure that we know for sure it's COVID before we count it. In Clallam County, one of the unfortunate realities that we're facing is that we have a very high rate of overdoses. And so we've had quite a few people who have died at home and who also tested positive for COVID, and we didn't know which one it was. And so we needed to wait until we got the toxicology back to make sure that we were really counting COVID deaths when they were COVID deaths and not misattributing something else. Unfortunately, because of funding issues at the medical examiner level statewide, there's been a big backlog of toxicology. And so we had several pending cases that we were just waiting for the toxicology to come back. And then when that finally got finalized at the end of the year, we had a big surge of those folks who turned out to be COVID deaths. It wasn't an overdose or anything else we checked, but it really was someone who died at home positive for COVID. And really died. The most likely source that we could find was of COVID. In some cases, we actually requested autopsies if there wasn't any other reason. All of those data came in all in a big chunk. And so it looked like a surge, but it was actually spread over the last 6 months. The other thing that affected that was there was a ransomware attack on a neighboring health jurisdiction in Kitsap. And so they had a problem accessing their own medical record system, which is how they report deaths to us. So there were several Clallam County residents who died in Kitsap that we weren't notified about until they got their medical record system up and running. It's up and running now, and they were able to send in those reports to us. So those were all spread over the last 6 months of the year. We did have a small uptick in deaths in December, but nothing like a surge of 25 deaths, which was what we reported. The person who wrote in was asking if there's anything like that potentially pending for Jefferson. Thankfully, there is not. So The ransomware attack has been fixed. We have access to the medical records in Kitsap, and we haven't found any other deaths of Jefferson County residents related to that. And thankfully, while we do have a significant issue with substance use disorder and overdoses in our region, it's really not on the scale of what we're dealing with in Clallam. And so we've not seen that same level of issue with COVID-19 related deaths. The other thing that has helped us is thankfully we have a much lower rate of hospitalization and death in Jefferson County, and we have a better staffed public health department. And so we are still able to follow every hospitalization. We know whenever anyone is hospitalized with COVID, so we follow them all the way through their hospitalization, and we know when they die. So we always are able to track them, even if they're out of county. In Clallam, we have about half the staff that we have in Jefferson. So we haven't been able to track all those hospitalizations, and we have more hospitalizations. And so that's why we got affected more by the EMR change. So don't worry, we don't have a secret stash of COVID-19 deaths for Jefferson. It is really 34 at this point.
That answer really didn't make me feel any better though, Dr. Berry. I don't know. Don't worry, it's just the fentanyl and the ransomware attacks. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not. Not good things, but it's not COVID. But no, fentanyl is a really serious issue throughout the region, but it's hitting us really hard in Clallam right now. Couple other questions. This person said, I'm an at-risk individual. I'm very careful, but I've gotten COVID in the past and had, unfortunately, prolonged neurological COVID symptoms, which thankfully have since abated. I'm really glad that you're doing better. Long COVID is a really serious disease, and it can really dramatically affect your life. I'm really glad that things are moving in a better direction for you. This person was noting that they are now on medications that are contraindicated with Paxlovid, so they're not able to take those two together. Are there any folks who are currently now eligible for additional boosters, or is that kind of coming down the pike? And I would say at this point, unfortunately, no. Bivalent boosters, you only get one at this point, regardless of your underlying health status. The primary reason for that is that they are actually still working really well. Even for people who have underlying health conditions, the bivalents are still working really, really well. They're working incredibly well at preventing severe disease. They're also actually working well at preventing symptomatic disease as well. Not 100%, but they very much reduce your risk of catching and giving COVID to others. So that's all good things. I do suspect that there is some point in the future where the CDC will approve an additional booster for immunosuppressed populations. That tends to happen. We tend to have a shorter window for folks who are immunosuppressed, but we've not seen that come out yet. We will be following that, and we'll definitely put out a notice if and when that comes down. Otherwise, we anticipate that bivalents are likely going to be the recommended booster annually, and they'll update the formulation to match whatever the current circulating variant is, much like we do with the flu. But I'm very hopeful that we'll do a much better job of matching it in coming years, because we've put so many investments in place to sequence more quickly. So we've got a much better idea of what is circulating, and I think we'll be better able to tailor our vaccines. And the mRNA vaccines are really the big thing that made that possible. You can scale those up much more quickly than previous vaccines. So we are looking at probably annual boosters recommended for most people, but I would suspect that those who are immunosuppressed may have an additional booster recommendation coming in the coming months. This person was asking a little bit about how to utilize the case ascertainment rate. So they asked, you know, if this was based on last week's numbers, if the case rate was 240 per 100,000 and reporting a case ascertainment rate of 1 in 10, does that mean that the case rate is actually closer to 2,000 per 100,000? And the answer is yes. Actually. So currently our case rate is 168 per 100,000 with a case ascertainment rate of 1 in 13. That means currently our actual estimated case rate, factoring in how many COVID-19 cases we don't find out about, is a little bit over 2,000 cases per 100,000. This person said, I don't remember it ever being so high. Is that true? It actually has been that high. It was recorded at about 2,000 cases per 100,000 about this time last year in the original Omicron surge. At that point, we weren't kind of emphasizing case ascertainment rate as much, but the lowest case ascertainment rate we've ever gotten to in Jefferson County was about 1 in 2. So even then, you were talking a case rate of about 4,000 per 100,000. So we are seeing lower case rates right now than we did then. But we are also seeing just a change in severity of experienced disease in our community. It's not that the virus has become less severe, but it's because we have all these other things that are making it less severe for us, for most people. It's that we've got vaccines available. That's really reducing the severity at a population level. Many of us have had COVID-19 infections in the last couple of years, and that is also reducing severity at the population level. And we have good medication. So if you are eligible for Paxlovid, it works really well. So all of those things in combination do mean that we're in a quite a bit better place than we were even just this time last year. So we have to interpret the case rates differently now because we're just dealing with a different time in the pandemic. We have a lot more tools at our disposal to make things less severe at this point. This next person was asking about particularly waste related to disposable masks and whether or not reusing would be reasonable. This person reused their masks and actually spritzed them with what it looks like a sanitizer to potentially make them safer or make them last longer. That actually has been studied during the critical shortages that we were seeing in the very beginning of the pandemic. There were some trials looking at sanitizing and reusing N95s. And we actually did that in some of our counties, in Clallam County included. So we would send actual medical grade N95s, get them cleaned, and then bring them back and use them again. So it can be done. Generally, in the general public, we don't recommend cleaning disposable masks. In fact, some of the chemicals that you might use to clean them can actually make them work less well over time. What's more important as far as the longevity of your mask is how well it fits your face. And when we've studied that, when it comes to the higher quality, well-fitting masks like N95s, you can wear them for up to 5 days with a full 12-hour shift factored in there, because that's what we used to do in the ICU. So you can wear them for 12 straight hours, 5 days in a row. And then after that point, it starts to really lose its fit. And we don't recommend wearing it after that because you're not going to get as good of a seal. So you can reuse them. And you think of 5 days times 12 hours, it's over 100 hours of that mask. And I do recommend reusing them. I have a few KN95s that I rotate through because in most situations, I'm not wearing it all day. But when I'm in clinic where I wear it all day, and we have enough masks now and it gets contaminated on the outside, I do trade that out and then get a new one the next day. So it's a trick. It's a tricky situation. We don't want to make a lot of excess waste, but you do want to make sure that your mask works, especially if you have high-risk conditions yourself or high-risk folks at home. So you can reuse them for a while, but not forever. If it doesn't fit your face well, if you don't get a good suction, that means it's not fitting and you need to get a new one. This next person was talking about the upcoming notification that vaccinations are going to be privatized when likely around the time that we move out of the state of emergency. There were some very unfortunate announcements by the vaccine manufacturers, Pfizer and Moderna, that they were planning on dramatically increasing the cost of their vaccines. I am profoundly against that, especially for a vaccine that was predominantly funded by the United States government. There's really not a lot of excuse for that kind of behavior. And I hope that our federal government intervenes a bit on that, but we shall see. But the particular question here was when things become, more normal, more back to our traditional privatized healthcare system, does that mean that we'll have a little more control over the frequency of vaccines that we get? And generally, no. Generally, pharmacies and doctors still follow the ACIP recommendations, so the American College of Immunization Practitioners, that recommend the frequency and timing of boosters. That frequency is not really determined based on how we pay for things. It's determined based on your immune system. And how frequently you can stimulate the immune system and at what intervals to get the best response. So that's why we've talked a bit on this program about how you can get a booster as soon as 2 months after your last one. But if you can, I recommend stretching that to 4 because you're going to get a stronger immune response. That's all just based on the complexity of how your immune system functions. So I don't think we're going to see that you can kind of get vaccines whenever you feel like your immune system is fading or every 3 months. I think most practitioners are still going to follow the ACIP recommendations, but I am closely following how the payment system is going to work. Because while there are many things challenging about this emergency, there are some good things that came out of it, like making sure that everyone had access to vaccines, whether they could pay or not, making sure everyone had access to telehealth and Paxlovid prescriptions, whether they could pay or not. And unless we put in place policy at largely the federal level, that's all going to go away. And we're going to see a big split in inequities, which we've already seen in this pandemic, but we're likely to see it worsen significantly after those funding streams go away. This next person was asking a bit about case rates. About a year ago, we were talking about when it might make sense to discontinue mask wearing. And back then we said, if we got less than 100 cases per 100,000. Now we are, as we kind of mentioned a little bit earlier in the program, in a really different phase in the pandemic, and it's really harder to tie our behavior specifically to case rates. Part of that is because we have this very low case ascertainment rate. We know we aren't catching all the cases that are out there. But part of that also is that most of those cases are not as severe as they used to be. Back in the day, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a single COVID-19 case, the vast majority of them were incredibly severe, and we're ending up back in the beginning, many, many cases, a much higher percentage of COVID-19 cases were incredibly severe. So at a population level, it was incredibly important to reduce overall transmission so that we wouldn't shut down society, overrun our hospitals, lose our ability to function. Because even a virus that led to 10% hospitalization rates, which it did at one point in this pandemic, when millions of us are getting it at the same time, meant that the healthcare system would shut down. We're not at that point right now because we have all these other tools. And so I don't think I would recommend tying behavior exclusively to case rate now the same way we did. I would tailor it more based on your own risk, the risk of your household, and the environment that you're in. So for instance, a bus, a train, a plane, still a good place to wear a high quality mask. A crowded indoor setting, say, you know, you went to an indoor dance party and there's hundreds of people very close together, I'd wear a high quality mask in a space like that. But if you're going into a store that's pretty well ventilated, that has a lot of space between you and other people, that's a space that if you're low risk, the people in your household are low risk, it might be reasonable to go ahead and go without a mask. So I think we can start to be a little bit more nuanced in how we decide to wear masks. I don't think it's an all or nothing thing. And as we move into a safer and safer part of this pandemic, I think we can liberalize that even more. The last question on this set was that about which vaccine to get. So this person has a five-year-old who's almost eligible for their bivalent booster, and they wanted to know if they should get the Moderna or Pfizer. And the answer is, if you're five or up, you can get either one. They're all fine. If you're under five, you have to get the one that you got before. It's the only group that has to stick with their primary series. We are hopeful that come next fall, when we move to likely annual boosters, there will be a much simpler recommendation, which is you just got to get a bivalent of some kind, and it won't be this kind of brand preference. But right now, if you're under five, you have to stick with your prior version. If you're five or over, you can get whichever one is available to you, and I'd recommend getting whichever one your local pharmacy or healthcare provider is carrying. Then I did get one question, it looks like we have a little bit more time, which was about bird flu. There was a kind of scary looking article about pandemic influenza related to birds, and that kind of suggesting that it might be just around the corner. And this writer asks that I respond to that. So in the background, while we're doing all this other COVID stuff and flu stuff and RSV stuff, we actually also have been tracking avian influenza this whole time. So whenever a bird in our jurisdiction tests positive for avian influenza, we get a notification at the Department of Public Health. And we then contact every person that came in contact with that bird and then monitor them for their symptoms. Throughout the country, we have monitored thousands and thousands of individuals who have been in contact with birds who had avian influenza. Thankfully, only one in the entire country has developed symptoms and tested positive for avian influenza themselves. So thankfully, this round of avian influenza does not appear to be transitioning into humans. It is decimating bird populations right now. That's part of what is driving the cost of eggs that people are noticing. That's actually bird flu is driving a lot of that because it's so deadly, especially to crowded flocks of birds. You lose entire flocks of chickens, entire flocks of ducks very, very quickly. And so it's really, really affecting the poultry industry right now. And it's actually affecting wild bird populations as well. In neighboring Clallam County, we've seen quite a few bald eagles positive for avian influenza and Canada geese. We've had several die-offs related to that. If you have a backyard flock, I do. There are some recommendations for how to keep them safe. The ones you'll generally see from USDA recommend kind of isolating them from all other birds. That can be very hard if you have free-range birds, and depending on your setup, can really limit their access to other things that are important for their health. One thing that we have seen when we've been tracking these other avian influenza cases is that the biggest risk factor appears to be a water source. So if you have a pond on your property, a stream that migrating birds come to and they mix with your poultry, that's a really high risk factor for getting transition into your birds. So be very thoughtful about your birds and keeping them away from water sources on your property. If you do that, you're likely to do well. As far as transition to humans, I think we always, throughout history, have seen spillover of viruses into the human population. When you get what's called an antigenic shift of that virus, it can sometimes then develop the ability to infect humans. We've seen that with avian influenza, was previously called swine flu back in 2009. We saw that with COVID-19. And so I think it does raise the issue of how critical it is to monitor viruses and other pathogens in animals. The health of our natural world and the health of people is intimately connected. They are not separate. And so we have to pay attention to that. We also have to pay attention to how much our environment, how many incursions we're having into the natural world. As we expand the places that we live further and further into the woods, just like you see more cougars showing up in people's properties, you see more crossover as we have more and more interaction with animals. We think that's likely what happened in China. There's populations who live very near bats, and they've been seeing spillover of coronaviruses into that population for quite some time. So that all to say, we need to pay attention to how we treat our natural world. We need to pay attention to spillover, and we need to maintain and actually further invest in public health infrastructure to monitor these things. There is a strong desire, I am hearing, to kind of go back to everything the way it was before, including that the public health department should go back to being shoestrings the way they used to be. Not hearing that from this body, but it's a kind of a general thing that we hear. And I think it's important to pay attention to that, and that we need to be ready for the next pandemic, because there will be another one. And we've learned so much from this pandemic. Now we need to apply it. And that means, in large part, we need to have a workforce that's ready to respond to it and ready to sequence these kind of variants so that we know that it's coming and we can jump on it more quickly next time. And with that, I'm happy to take any other questions that might have come up. Yes, Heidi.
So on the bird flu front, do you know how many cases of bird flu we've had in Jefferson County over the last, I don't know, year or?
We've had no human cases, but I have to take a look at how many reported birds we've gotten. So it's one of the limitations is that it's only the birds that are reported. Mm-hmm. And that is most commonly going to be domesticated fowl because people are following them very closely. But we do get, because we have a wildlife preservation group here. We do get reports from them sometimes when they take in a sick bird. And then we track those and track the people who interacted. But at this point, it's throughout the flyway. And so if you see a sick bird out there, you definitely want to exercise caution. We have had really nice well-wishers who brought sick birds into wildlife preserves with bare hands without any masks on, and they've been potentially exposed. So if you choose to help a sick bird, make sure you're wearing gloves, make sure you're wearing a mask. It makes a huge difference to reduce any risk of spillover. But I would say it's really throughout our flyway at this point. We're really seeing a pretty extensive viral transmission in this area.
I've been keeping my eyes open for it because we have our own backyard flock, as does Commissioner Brotherton. I'm not sure if Commissioner Dean does it.
Not anymore.
But yeah,
we say it's almost a whole group of chicken owners.
Yeah, we've got about 2 dozen birds on our poultry on our property, but also we have a lot of wild birds. And so I've just been watching very closely and I haven't seen one sick bird. And I'm like, cross your fingers. But, you know, I just haven't heard of any local kind of statistics or even cases of it. So just curious about that.
We definitely continue to get a slow drip of cases, mostly eagles. We've been seeing a lot of bald eagles testing positive because they eat carrion. And so they go and find a dead bird. And then they pick up bird food that way.
So my other question that came up is, someone asked me this over the weekend, is the garbage created from all these masks, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm assuming masks are mostly made out of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Plastic paper. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been over the entire pandemic wearing my cloth mask and washing my cloth mask and only being a cloth mask person, but just living in kind of terror of the amount of garbage we're creating. Have you heard of any coordinated or organized conversations about disposing of masks, recycling masks? I haven't heard anything.
You know, I haven't either. And I think it's a really good point to raise, because I'm sure we're not the only folks who've noticed that we've generated a lot of garbage related to this. I think it's a really interesting topic that I think deserves more exploration. I'm not sure the capability of recycling these, just based on the way that they're structured, and also based on the fact that they're generally considered contaminated after you use them. And so the disposal of, you know, in the medical system, the disposal of them is different than the kind of standard disposal because it potentially could have pathogens on it. But I think it's something that does need to be considered. How do we dispose of them safely and properly? I think one key thing that we have seen is a rise in mask-related litter. It makes sense. I keep them in my car. You close your car, they fall out. It's just a good thing to pay attention to make sure that we are being mindful of our environment, that we're not dropping them around. Those loops make me nervous for something that an animal could get caught in. So we'll just being thoughtful about litter, trying not to, and then trying to make sure that if you see some, you pick it up and throw it away.
Cut the loops. Mm-hmm. Like you cut the pop bottle. Pop bottle.
I think it's a good idea. It hasn't been a formal recommendation yet, but it seems like a reasonable move to me.
Well, so I've been working with fiberglass boat recycling for a number of years, and we can recycle fiberglass boat hull particulate, and it's used as fuel in kilns for concrete creation. Mm-hmm. So plastic can be, has a second life in that way, other than recycling. So I wonder if we could create a similar stream for masks. I don't know. I'm just trying to think outside the box because I was asked the question at the library this weekend, and then I woke up in the middle of the night about it last night. Like, how can we actually mobilize a mask recycling effort? Anyway, so
I think it's a good idea to look into it.
Fuel in concrete kilns?
They use plastic, fiberglass has more burn value.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a solution to me, but okay.
It is. They use a lot of, you would be surprised.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, probably air quality questions, all kinds of things.
Yeah. So there's some fodder for Stephen for his next column or somebody else.
I have another question about masks, Dr. Berry. So is the recommendation still primarily for surgical and KN94, 95. And I ask partly because I'm having to mask a lot now with an immunocompromised person in my household. And especially when I go to the gym where I'm masking, it is, you know, reminded how uncomfortable it is to be hot and sweaty in a mask. Are there any alternatives that are considered more breathable?
I mean, the challenge, of course, is the breathability gets you into the problem of not getting enough prevention of viral particles coming your way. Generally, if I'm in a situation where I'm going to be masking for a long time, and I don't think it's an incredibly high risk situation, you know, not an airplane or a bus, I tend to use a surgical mask in most of those cases. So for instance, you know, I've been to your chambers. They aren't usually super packed. On a not super packed day, I think it might be reasonable to use a surgical mask. They're a little easier to wear. Some folks find them easier to exercise in if you're going to be exercising in one. But because the KN95s, it's just really hard to pull the air through there when you're exercising. So if you're really working on protection of yourself, that's going to be your best bet to reduce your risk. And of course, looking at other modifications. So can we make sure that there's excellent ventilation in the place that you work out? Can we make sure we go at times when there aren't that many people so you can maybe get away with not masking? Any of those other changes can be options to reduce the need for masks when it's really not convenient.
Thank you.
Well, one or two questions raised by your talk today, Dr. Barry. One is that, and this is sort of unrelated to why you're here, but you said that doctors used to spend 12 hours in emergency rooms. Has that blessedly changed to a shorter period?
Depends on the type of work that you do. But many shifts in the hospital are still 12 hours. Wow. Some are closer to 8, but many, many are 12. So when I was working inpatient, there was just one of us for night and one of us for day. And we each work 12. And it's really common among hospitalists.
And then I guess a comment really is, as we go into the cessation, the end of the emergency on the federal level, you know, let us know about advocacy opportunities to preserve the slack in our medical system. Because I think that I certainly, and I think I speak for everyone here when I say that resilience and slack seems to be really critical as we move forward. This is not the last infectious disease that we're going to deal with, or other population scale health risk that we want to, you know, I don't know. It's really, this process has really changed my approach to things. And I really look at use a population lens when I'm thinking about health issues. And I just hope that you'll let us know when there are opportunities to trumpet what we've been doing and this kind of approach for the medical system.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we have learned, unfortunately, sometimes through really painful experiences in the last few years, is that our health is all connected and that our medical system is fragile, more fragile than it needs to be. There are some ways we could build a lot more resilience into the system, and we could build a system that doesn't rely so much on a patchwork for-profit system. We could also build a system in which places were adequately staffed so that we don't have to make everybody work around the clock for 3 years when this happens again, because it really has limited our resilience for the next couple of years because we've lost so many people. There's only so long that you can be a hero. Many, many people have burned out in the last few years, and it doesn't have to be that way. We could build a more resilient system down the road.
Thanks. And then finally, so XBB 1.5 is the one that has the monster name, right? Mm-hmm, but I'm not going to use it either. I'm not going to support it. I do think we need to come up with a new naming convention, because I'm not going to remember XBB 1.5, but the others burned into my brain. So I don't know. Maybe we could like hurricane name, you know? Like,
yeah, we could start with like letters of the alphabet. I think that's a great idea.
My real question though is, how do you think it came here? Because this was kind of a surprise. I think the last report, it was not the dominant strain, if I recall correctly. And so I'm just curious if you have a narrative arc that you can put on that, to how these very similar, you know, Omicron variants, you know, outcompeted each other.
Sure. So yeah, XBB1's primarily, the primary benefit it has, the transmission advantage it has, is that it is more contagious than everything that's come before it. It does have a greater ability to get around prior infection in particular. It is thankfully is not that great about getting around the bivalent, but it is great at getting around old vaccines. And so while we are much better vaccinated than the rest of the state and the country, we're still only about 50% vaccinated. Half of us still have not gotten their bivalent. We're at least about 50% up to date in our vaccines. And so there's many of us that are not adequately protected against XBB, and it is very, very contagious. And so that transmission advantage has caused it to grow. That said, that growth has been much, much slower here than everywhere else. So on the East Coast, it took about 3 weeks to just overtake everything, the same way old school Omicron did. But here, it went really slowly, just slowly creeped up. And it's still, we have actually a much broader array of subvariants here than we have in other areas because of that slow rise. And we think the biggest driver of that slow rise and the persistence of other variants is that we're so well vaccinated. And so when XBB finds someone, we've seen this happen in a lot of households that we've been tracking, one person gets it, but actually the whole household doesn't get it anymore. And then no one else does because people are getting symptoms earlier. And then not transmitting until later. And people are masking, people are well vaccinated, just not getting it at all. And so it's stopping in its tracks here in a way that it didn't in other areas. But it's still more contagious, so it will still find people that it can transmit through. But we're just not seeing the kind of really concerning surge that we saw on the East Coast.
That makes good sense. Thank you. Any last questions for Dr. Barry?
No.
All right, I got one more for you.
Okay.
Just to fill in for Willie here. And that's, you talk about a lot of the functions of masking. And when I was, a young man teaching English in Asia, the big use of masks were if you were a little bit sick or something, had a cold and you were going to continue in your life, you wore it as source control to prevent the spread to other people. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that application of it, if that's something that we should also be pushing as part of the, poo-poo platter, and what you think about that idea.
No, that's one other really good way. And so thank you for asking that question. In many other parts of the world, if you feel a little bit sick, maybe you're a little bit sick. If you're really sick, you stay home. But if you're feeling a little bit sick, a little sniffly, mild cough, you wear a mask to make sure you don't give it to other people. And that's a really great use of masks. If we all have had that moment where you're not flu sick, but maybe you're a little sick, or maybe you're just tired. Who knows? That's a good time to go ahead and put on your mask, because you can still go out and be in your life, but you're much less dangerous to the people around you. That's actually how we've been using them in medicine for the longest time. But it was because we used to send doctors and nurses to work with high fevers. We just didn't give them days off, and we just slap a mask on and tell them it was fine. We don't do that anymore, but it is something important that we can do for that early infection or the tail end of an infection, where sometimes you're still coughing, you feel a little gross, but it's been a week and you think you're not contagious anymore, but you might be a little. That's a good time to wear a mask. And so that's definitely how I practice in my family. I have a toddler. She's not as great of a mask wearer as she used to be now that the whole rest of the world isn't wearing masks. But if she's sick, we enforce it. If she's a little bit sniffly, put it on when we go to the grocery store. And that makes a huge difference. I can feel more confident that I can take her to the grocery store and she's not going to get other people sick while she's there. So times to wear a mask. In summary, if you feel a little off, you think you might be a little bit sick. If you think you might've been exposed to COVID, that's another good time. And then if you're in a very crowded setting, or if you're high risk or someone in your household is, those are the times to wear a mask at this point. But if you're well, you don't feel sick at all, you don't have high-risk family members, and you want to take a brief step into a store without a mask, I think that's a reasonable thing to do at this point, if that's something you're interested in doing.
But just to, and this because I heard this anecdote from someone that they were, in a class with someone and someone was wearing a mask and they're like, oh, are you feeling a little under the weather? Oh, I have COVID, but don't worry, I'm wearing the mask.
Yes.
If you test positive, stay home.
Yes. If you're very ill or if you're positive, please stay home with COVID at least 5 days. And ideally, you should be feeling quite a bit better before you come out to the world. It's not a panacea wearing a mask. Please don't come out into the world feeling very, very ill, because you could still get someone sick. You're just less likely to with a mask on.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Barry. And I think that your next scheduled time with us is a holiday. So you'll be here on Tuesday, the 21st, instead of Monday.
I will. Happy to.
Great. So send the questions in. Thanks to the listeners from KPTZ and to you, Dr. Barry, for continuing to come out and have these talks with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.